When I look at, again, when we ask the question, what does intrusive parenting look like? I'm just going to focus on three in the article that IMFC has just published, focuses on these three areas. The notion of manipulative parenting. Again, when we look at manipulative parenting, we're talking about strategies where parents use techniques to, again, gain an understanding from their child that they want obedience rather than actually internalizing these behaviors. Let me give you a couple examples from one of the questionnaires that Bart Sonnen and some of his colleagues from Ghent University use. They have a psychological control scale, and here's some of the items that kids would respond to in regards to some of these areas of functioning. My parents are less friendly to me if I don't see things like they do. My parents are always trying to change how I feel or think about things. My parents will avoid looking at me when I have disappointed him or her. Again, these are really subtle things that you and I do in response to our children's behavior that in the moment seem quite reasonable, rational, and even actually fit the situation. The problem is though, what we're seeing is that a certain proportion of parents are using these as their primary parenting techniques. They're using these emotional cutoffs. They're using these techniques that are actually draining these kids of the ability to show this autonomous behavior. Well, look at that second one on parental constraining. That girl that I quoted at the beginning of the study, when she came in, she was a 13-year-old girl, quite articulate, quite, you know, in fact, when we looked at her report card, this was a B+ student. This was not a failing, unacademically motivated student. When we sat in the interview room with the mom and her, I was sitting behind, as I usually do, the one-way glass and observing my graduate students as they're working with these kids. And I saw this girl looking directly at the one-way glass, and my first thought was, oh my goodness, she can see through the glass, you know, and I started to feel a bit uncomfortable. Because what was happening was, as I was listening to my graduate student interview this parent, the graduate student would address the girl, but the mom would answer all of the questions. And so the girl was just, she was not looking at me, she was looking through this situation and going, this is a parent who has really taken the power and autonomy away from this child and is truly a spectator to her own kind of parent-child relationship. That's what we mean by parental constraining, those activities that truly disempower and take away the opportunity for the child to express his or her strengths. Corporal punishment, don't even think for a minute I'm going to address that in this crowd. We're going to pass that. Right on. You'll have to read about that in the paper. So the question then becomes, well, how do parents get out of control? And I'm leading up to the punchline here. How do parents get out of control with control? Well, there's a couple of areas where, again, from the research, we're finding that parents are vulnerable in finding themselves getting way out of balance in regards to how they use control with their children. One of them has to do with what we've called pressure from above. That's simply negative life events that happen and the family is responding to those either crises or trauma or pressure, and as a result, we find ourselves doing things to our kids in the name of control that are very unhealthy. And again, I think of the situations where we're in a time now in our culture where economically things have been, you know, we've had thousands of families in Canada who've had to, fathers and mothers had to come home and say, wow, things are going to be different because of a loss in job or a cutback in hours. As a result, the pressure within that family ramps up. And we find, again, parents, quite naturally, as that pressure ramps up, we tend to try and control things in our families that we can't control in other areas of our lives. And as a result, our children suffer from that. You'll see there, I've noted from Gronick's study in particular, that these outside pressures tend to happen and show themselves in single-parent families, of which the majority, as we know, is mothers. And so when we're talking about the role of mothers, single mothers, in the lives of parenting their children, we're talking about a vulnerable population here again who is may find themselves using these psychological control principles, again, with the best intentions of raising healthy and happy children, but as a result of this, creating or contributing to some anxiety within that child. Another pressure is what we call pressure from below. All of us have children for whom temperaments push our buttons. I have three children. They are all extremely different. Short of doing a paternity check and making sure that they're all mine, they couldn't be as much similar as they are in many ways, personality and temperament-wise, they are very different. And we know the difficulty of dealing with simply difficult children. In fact, thanks to David, I took a plane flight out with about six of them right around my seat, all the way from Calgary. And thank you. The essence here is that this is not a one-way parent-to-child parenting style. That in fact, our children evoke from us unique parenting styles. Each of our kids do that. And we know that for a good percentage of the population, they have difficult children, either by temperament, they're antagonizing, they're naturally irresponsible. Of course, in the clinic that I work in, we see lots of children with learning disabilities and attention deficit disorders. They are just naturally more complex to parent. And as a result of this, we see parents who, in their best attempts to control their children, find themselves using these psychological control techniques. And of course, what happens is you get this spiraling down of relationship and behavior throughout the whole family system. The last one was kind of unique, this notion of pressure within, in the sense that we can talk here about things like boundary enmeshment, separation anxiety. What we talk about here is that some interesting work coming out of Bart Sonnen's work again at University of Ghent, where they've looked at parents of 25 to 29 year olds, and you've all seen the statistics, right? And we're all fearful of them. That upwards of 30 to 40% of 25 to 29 year olds are still living at home with their parents. Correct? We know this data exists there. One of the things that's surprising that's coming out of Sonnen's and others' work is that parents themselves are not, they're the ones that are having the separation anxiety issue in not wanting to let their kids go. In fact, when you ask parents, are you distressed at all that you have a 34-year-old living in your basement? The majority of parents in these studies will say, no. He's welcome here as long as he wants to stay. There isn't that. I don't know about you, but when I graduated from grade 12, I got a set of luggage. Which, that was hard to misinterpret that message that I was being sent. My parents love me and I love them, but they want to love me from a distance. Very interesting how this notion of separation anxiety that we usually attribute to the child is now actually we're looking at the role that separation anxiety is having on parents not wanting to let go of their children. And I mean no disrespect if you are or have a 30-year-old living in your basement. I apologize. The last one I want to talk about is this notion of fear of failure. And here's where I want to jump to my last slides, where we ask, where does parental control live? Where do we see psychological control really breeding and existing a lot? Well, one of them is in the notion of academics. We know that we live in a competitive culture. We know that we live in an educational culture that is bent on and exists on this notion of success and excelling. And not surprisingly, I see a lot of this in our clinic, where we have parents coming in, just like this 13-year-old girl, who are doing just fine academically. They're doing just fine socially. And yet the parent asks, well, they're not like their sister. why aren't they doing, or they're not like me, like she's struggling with, you know, she's a half grade level behind in reading, and we want to know why this is. And again, I'm not disparaging at all concern for that parents have for their children's performance, but one of the things we're seeing is that this parent ego for achievement is really being imposed on children and their anxiety levels. Another one is this notion of, I see this a lot in athletics, and again, we've all just come through kind of an emotional high as Canada hosting the Olympics. It's very interesting about, we're actually going to capture this. We're going to do some studies because we have the Centre for Excellence of in Calgary and Hockey Canada and a bunch of the international, or sorry, the national sport bodies hosting in Canada. We're going to start tracking the engagement of children with engagement with sports and looking at the prominence and presence of psychological control for children that are considered what we call elite athletes. Because we're concerned that, again, and I'll talk from the hockey perspective, we're concerned that even though we have hundreds of thousands of kids playing hockey, by the time they get into the bantam and midgets age, irrespective of how gifted or not they are, we see a huge decline in dropout. I coach softball again in Calgary. 10 years ago, we had 3,000 girls playing softball. Now we have about 600 in a city the size of Calgary. And so that is a huge decline, not all due to this, but we're concerned about, again, this achievement. So where does this leave us? And I'm going to end with this. Where do we go from here? One of the things I want to leave you with is a couple of messages that I don't want you to leave with, and that's one that psychological control, there is not a direct causal link between psychological control and child psychological distress. This is correlational research that includes a whole context of issues here. So don't leave here thinking that if you use, and even if this is your primary method, or if this is our primary method of parenting, that we're going to create this. But I do want to say again, Barbara's research talks about the pervasive and long-term effects. They've been studying a cohort of about 1,200 kids. They're in their 12th year of that study. And they're finding that parents who struggle with balancing the use of psychological control are seeing kids that have both depression and heightened antisocial behavior. Where do I leave this on a positive note? And I'll finish with this. I think from an institute perspective and from a social policy perspective, we really need to always encourage what I'd call, or what others have called, autonomy supportive parenting. We need to give control back to parents in allowing them to parent their children, but we also need to equip and educate them. I think that's a message we've heard consistently all day today, and I resonate with the other speakers to say we're in a culture now that that again has this panic for achievement and doing best and being excellent and being triple A and being everything else that and in fact the research is so clear that good enough parenting leads to more than good enough kids, and the research on resilience would testify to that. And the last thing I'll say is this notion of one of the areas that we're studying, and particularly through my research with the IMFC, is looking at family strengths and also looking at ecological contexts that help children to develop in things like character and competency, and these are the things that we can assist parents with and allow them to parent in the best way that they can. I'm going to stop there. We've got just a few minutes left. One of the things that Dave said to me was, Kelly, we want to make our conference more Oprah-like. And so, you know how Oprah gives away things at the end of her shows? Well, we're going to, my beautiful spokesmodel, Andrea here, is going to be handing out to you copies of the newest review paper for IMFC. It's not a car. No, it's not a car. I do have a 2000 Nissan Maxima that I'm trying to sell, but probably not the best place. So anyways, as Andrea hands those out, I'll thanks for your attention, and good to be with you today.
Of course, the first thing I checked as I came rushing up to see Kelly was that my zipper was done up. Kelly, as always, it is a pleasure, and thank you very much for bringing your wit, your insights, and your writing as well. I think you're going to enjoy the paper as it comes around. Probably not best to read it in the next 10 minutes, but please take it with you and read it. Give us some feedback. We always appreciate that as well. We do have a few minutes for questions and answers. As always, I would ask if you keep your questions short and straight to the point, and then Kelly can answer a number of questions as we go through here. So.
Thanks a lot for your talk. I enjoyed it. I wanted to ask you if you had any data on, you talked about the psychological control techniques, if there's any data or studies about passive versus active use of those techniques.
If I understand your definition, like mine for active versus passive, I think, again, one of the things I've yet to meet a parent who intentionally says, I want to psychologically harm my child. Literally, and almost like we heard one of our speakers say earlier today, what happens is we tend to get in these behavioral patterns that as a result of those behavioral patterns, we then justify that behavior through all sorts of self-talk and so what I find is that as far as passive and active, they've looked at, again, everything from body language to subtle lack of eye contact. Again, things that we would look at and say, these are just normal parts of human communication. But in fact, what parents will say, and again, I keep coming back to this 13-year-old girl because she's so vivid in my mind, where she would, when the mother addressed the question to the daughter, she would immediately look down to the floor and as a clinical psychologist, we look for those types of behavioral things that suggest, wow, this is a pattern of behavior that is, again, whether it's active or passive, and again, whether it's intentional or not, we still see these long-term effects of that. I don't know if that addressed or not.
You seem to be skirting around the term of sort of trophy child phenomenon. Parents who somehow find their own status. And I'm wondering if this isn't a consequence of basically lack of clarity about the function of the family.
Yes.
And I'm reminded of Herb Ratner, the pediatrician philosopher behind La Leche League, said at one point that the function of a family is not the intellectual development of the child, but rather the cultivation of emotional security.
Yeah.
Better, he said, to be a well-adjusted truck driver than a neurotic psychologist. Could you comment?
Let me just take a drink while I... Yeah. Well, let me comment on the trophy child phenomena. I go back to that. The pressure within parents is really strong in the sense that what some of the research is showing is that parents who are insecure with their own identity and self-status, again, tend to live that through their children. It's hard to separate whether this is also a genetic, biological phenomena that, again, is part of that nature-nurture controversy, certainly part of that parent-child attachment issue. But we do see, and again, I'm going to. It's easier for me to talk anecdotally sometimes. We see in the clinic, we do assessments for gifted children, both referred by the school and self-referred by the parent. One of the hardest tasks my grad students have to do, because they do all the hard work, is sitting down with a parent, sadly, and telling them, your child has an average IQ. And now you can't believe, we don't get reactions like that, I'll tell you that. We get disappointment, we get tears, we get anger, we get frustration. Some of us pine for being told that our children are normal and average, like I said, it's very disconcerting to me that, that's not the uniform reaction, but we do get that, and my concern again is that, just like that 13-year-old girl, they'll shop until they find somebody who says, yeah, your child is special, your child is unique, and as a result, that adds a whole nother level of pressure onto both the child and to that parent-child relationship.
Kelly, thank you very much.